Thank you, George. Real good. Am I here? Would you explain verse 1 with the showing how it is the beast standing there? Is it from the text that were used for the different translations? I noticed there were several that did change it.
Yeah, it's a textual issue, but the text of the New American Standard has the dragon, and it looks to me, the reason I favor that myself is because what difference would it make where John stood when he's seeing the vision? But it seems like to me it does make a point by having the dragon as the one standing on the seashore, because it becomes obvious now the dragon is not just a different viewpoint of the beast.
Right. I looked through and I did see a few other translations that way that did point out it was
John,
the dragon standing there, the dragon. And then John saw the other coming up out of the sea still, and I appreciate that point. Yeah. Thank you.
Go get right here next to Brian.
That's powerful, George. That's good. I want to make a comment, and you can just comment on it too if you'd like to. What you presented, you know, obviously we would believe to be the truth. However, to most folks and most religious folks, it's just not exciting enough. And we live in a world that's shallow. We have shallow thinkers for the most part. And we simply want to be entertained. We don't want to think. We want someone to think for us. We want people to entertain us. And people can take advantage of that and come up with all of these fanciful ideas of one world antichrist coming at the end of time. And you know, things that are happening right now sure seem to point to that, so they say. And so one of the problems we have in trying to understand this is that unfortunately we become shallow thinkers and not biblical thinkers. So you can call me on that if you like.
Yeah. Well, just the entire futurist approach to the book of Revelation, where from chapter 4 to the end of the book has not yet been fulfilled. None of it's been fulfilled. None of it has meaning until the very end of world history, makes the book of Revelation meaningless to the original recipients. It means nothing. What would the seven churches of Asia who are suffering persecution, what good would it help them to know at the end of world history there'll be someone even worse than what we're going through, and the brethren at the end of history will suffer from an antichrist? They needed something for them in their situation to encourage faithfulness. And so I think we need the futurist position of interpreting Revelation falls on the rocks on that point, in my opinion.
Appreciate your talk. Just a note, when you mention people like deists being the Antichrist, and of course your explanation of the beast, I couldn't help but get to your conclusion before you did about our current government, and our own founding fathers were deists at best. Yes. We best not lionize them as we do. But also I wanted to ask, are there any in the denominational world that have the correct view of the Antichrist, or are they almost all dispensational premillennialists?
No, the dispensational premillennialists are the most, they get the most press. But there's a lot of people that don't accept their interpretation of Revelation. However, having said that, almost every commentary that I've ever looked at does believe that there is that all of this is pointing forward to one last great Antichrist that is to come. And maybe there will be, but it looks to me like that the tenor of the scripture is that it just keeps happening, cyclical. Each new generation, there it happens all over again. And I have no doubt that the final generation that is alive when the Lord comes will have their own Antichrist. So.
You may have just answered this. Thank you very much, by the way. It was very, very informative. But in 1 John 2:18, when John says, as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come, does this mean that the early Christians thought that there was a Antichrist, the definite article, the Antichrist? And is John correcting that idea? Or how are we to understand this expression, that the Antichrist is coming and many Antichrists have come? If you can help me with that passage.
Well, every time the word Antichrist is used in the singular, it always has the definite article, always. And so in these other passages, you'll notice, for example, 1 John 2:22, in the little booklet I handed to you, I have the in brackets. That's not in the New King James Version, but it is in the original Greek. And so Paul says he is the Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. And they knew there was the Antichrist coming, and they were just simply being taught. I don't know that they had a misconception of one individual person. I don't know. But if that's what they did think, John does certainly correct that in verse 18.
So could it be that the Antichrist is the spirit of Antichrist in 1 John 4 and verse 3? When he speaks of it in a definite sense, it's more of the spirit of Antichrist.
Well, that's true, but he's also speaking of it in a definite sense in all those other passages as well. But
First John chapter 4, verse 3, every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. As I understand it, has come is in the perfect tense in the Greek. And I've read fairly wide speculation about what the significance of that might be. It seems like there are two views that make sense to me, that being one, that the significance of the perfect tense would be that the results of his coming are what is in the perfect tense, being that the results last through to today. The other possible view in my mind that makes sense is that maybe the passage should be interpreted that Jesus Christ has come and remains in the flesh as he ascended and remains in the flesh in his glorified body. And to add to that, 2 John chapter 1, verse 7, has a similar thought to 1 John chapter 4, verse 3, but in this verse, when we see those who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh, I think coming there is in the aorist tense, if I'm not mistaken, meaning that it refers to simply a point in time. And then I've got one more to add, if I can, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Paul says that, let's see, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 4, referring to Jesus, that he was buried and that he rose on the third day, and I believe rose is in the perfect tense in the Greek as well. So my question is there a significance to any of that? And if so, would you just comment on it?
Well, this is actually dealing with the topic I had a couple years ago, I think, on the bodily resurrection. I think Jesus still is in the flesh. And I think 1 John 4 teaches that from that perfect tense. But I'd really rather maybe save that for maybe a repeat study on the bodily resurrection than to get sidetracked from Revelation 13 here. Just The point of these passages is that the spirit of the Antichrist was already in the world in the days of John, and it just continues on through the second coming of the Lord. I'm not trying to hedge there, but I think I can't look at 1 Corinthians 15 at the Greek and think right now about the tenses of that passage. I don't have my materials to check that out. So,
Brother Barshaw.
Thanks, George. I thought it was a very good presentation. I love the introduction and how you made this. I really hadn't looked at it that way before, that the dragon was the one standing on the seashore, the father, and then the beast is the son. And so I differ from you, and I really want your opinion on 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I know that wasn't the focus of today's topic, but 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 gives a different picture of this man of sin, the man of lawlessness that Paul identifies. You know, the brethren there were expecting the second coming, and Paul tells them it's not going to occur until there's a falling away and apostasy. So there's going to be a falling away from the truth, and then the man of sin will come. And he calls him the son of perdition, which is a reference to Judas. I believe Judas was a disciple who fell away. So in the context, there's a falling away. And then the man of sin will be revealed. And there's two elements associated with him, which are replicated in chapter 13. He does many wonders and signs and works, miraculous things, and he deceives the people. And so those are the warnings. Whatever this entity is that's coming, it's going to do wonderful, miraculous things, and it's going to deceive people. And I love the picture that you gave of a counterfeit Christ, a counterfeit Savior, a counterfeit church, I believe. So I believe, and you referenced the Roman Catholic Church, obviously, and you think it's part of this Antichrist, but I think it's more specific. I don't believe that these opposing powers, you know, communism or Pol Pot or whoever it is, have religiously deceived the elect, certainly. And I believe that's the image that's being given here. The image in 2 Thessalonians 2 is that the elect, even the elect, are deceived because this son of perdition comes from the inside. In fact, he sits in the temple of God. He sits in the seat of authority. He's the man of lawlessness because he disregards the laws of the church, the traditions of the church. And he deceives the very elect. He causes the people to fall away. And I love the picture you give. And I think it applies specifically to the Roman Catholic Church because that is the image. There are still billions of people that follow after they still claim to be doing miracles. We have them in Columbia, Missouri. We have people that are, you know, claim that they can work miracles, and they have a shrine there in Columbia, Missouri, and people go there to pray and that sort of thing. I don't see that in communism or whatever, you know, particular entity, political entity arises. You know, Nero didn't deceive anybody. Everybody knew Nero was a pompous buffoon. When he played his fiddle, nobody thought he played well. But when the Pope, the false prophet, speaks, people get down before him and kiss his toe. So anyway, I guess just your comments on that and what Paul has to say in 2 Thessalonians and how it relates to Revelation 13. Thank you again.
Well, I don't believe that Revelation 13 is specifically talking about the medieval Catholic Church. I believe that it can be applied to the medieval Catholic Church. And there's a difference between what something meant when it was written versus how can it apply to each new regime that comes along. And so who that man of sin is in 2 Thessalonians 2, I'm still working on that one, okay? Because I'm sort of like Augustine, who said, I don't have any idea who that fella is. And there are many commentators that feel the same way. That's probably the most difficult passage in the entire New Testament, 2 Thessalonians 2. But the problem that this idea that this cannot be the Roman Empire, it looks to me like that is exactly what it is because of Daniel 7. It looks to me like Daniel 7 is look is the basis of Revelation 13. And these animals, the beast was the fourth empire that Daniel was looking forward to. There's no doubt about that being the Roman Empire. And the fact that John describes this beast as a leopard, a bear, and a lion, it looks to me like there can be no question that this is specifically talking about the Roman Empire. Now, it can't apply to other regimes that come along, but in that particular instance, it looks like the churches of Asia would have interpreted that as the Roman Empire.
Yeah, and again, I really, I'm sorry, can I just respond real quick? I'll sit down if you want me to. Okay. I love your the seven heads that you did. And the way that I see this is this: one of the heads was wounded, received a grave wound, but then was resurrected. And the Roman Catholic Church is the reincarnated Rome, right? So they actually model the Roman Catholic Church on the ecclesiastical, or the ecclesiastical church was modeled on the political Roman Empire. As you, I'm sure you know, they built the Roman Church on the model of Rome. And that's why you have, you know, the ecclesiastical divisions, the bishops, and all of that. It's a perfect model. And so to me, one of the heads, the head of Rome, as you pointed out very well, was wounded. And then to everyone's great surprise, it was resurrected. Rome still exists today. The popes consider themselves to be, you know, the Roman Empire. And so it fits perfectly, actually, this image of a wounded beast that is resurrected, that is brought back, and then begins persecuting the saints, in my mind, fits perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you, George. I had two questions. Bart covered the 2 Thessalonians. That was the first question, so I won't ask that one. This is more of a comment based on what Doug just said a few moments ago on the shallowness of understanding of the book of Revelation in particular. I just started teaching, coincidentally, on Revelation 13 yesterday, a four-part series, because I want to take our congregation through a study of really just chapter 13. And just to give you an example of how shallow people really approach this, you know, black folks, when Barack Obama got elected president, they thought he was the savior of, you know, the country. But then after he got in there for a while and started passing all these laws against God's people, then some people, not a lot, but some people kind of changed their view of him. But a lot of people just continually ignored the anti-scriptural things that he, you know, the homosexuality, that sort of thing. So, but they totally ignored the biblical things that he passed or promoted against the Bible solely because he was a black man. They ignored. So a lot of people, black folks, would have supported him if he came out and said Jesus was a hoax. They would have. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of shallow teaching about the book of Revelation, the Bible in particular, but I think that if we teach more on these kinds of things, there's going to be disagreement and different interpretations, but we have to get it out there so people can start thinking. Because like Doug said, it's mostly just entertainment and that type of thing. So it was mostly just a comment.
Thanks, George. I appreciated it very much. I learned a number of things. Thank you. But when you were, I liked the section when I think someone just said you were on the heads, and then you got into Nazi Germany, and then to Stalin. And I think this is because of a continuous historical background, you know. You're thinking, well, where are we at now? We're at number 4 or number 5. Where are we at? When are we going to get to number 7? What's number 7 going to be? And I thought I just might give you a chance to say, well, what does the number 7 have to do? Is there going to be a 7th head? You know, just maybe there's a little more we could, what does, why did he say seven heads?
Well, and I was using the seven heads just for illustrative purposes. I think seven was used because it's a symbolic number that means perfection completeness and perfection. And I think that the beast has seven heads because they symbolize all of the emperors of the entire Roman system throughout the entire Roman Empire. And I think that when I say the beast raises his head again, I mean the spirit of the beast leaves the body of the empire and then goes and inhabits a new body. You know, he takes over the Roman Catholic Church, and then he takes over communist regimes and so forth. And I just think that this spirit that is being illustrated here is to be understood as, how does this apply to me? Because that's how we do the seven letters, you know, to the church at Ephesus, to the church at Smyrna. If I find myself in a situation like Ephesus or like Smyrna, I must learn the same lessons they had to learn. But that doesn't mean that my situation is what the Lord was prophesying would come when He wrote that letter to Ephesus. He's not saying that my situation is what He was anticipating when He wrote the church at Laodicea. He was addressing those situations that existed in the first century when those seven churches were struggling against Rome and the emperor worship. And then if I find myself today in a situation where someone is demanding to be worshiped as God, or demanding my total allegiance, and they want the allegiance to the government to be above God, I'm facing the same situation that they were in.
First, just a quick comment about what was just said, and then I have something for you to critique. But remember, in the book of Revelations, when you see numbers, you don't count. Numbers count. They're significant. But when you see numbers in the book of Revelation, you don't count. Now, that sounds pretty innocent. But the point simply is, that will relate to determining what methodology you make your decisions about. So I don't want to deceive anybody, because that shows I've showed my hand. But just numbers are symbolic. My comment, George, is, as you pointed out, Satan lost when Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. In Revelation 12 and 10, it says, the accuser of the brethren was cast down. And he was cast down, as we see in Romans 3 and 25, because the righteousness of God was fully manifested. How he could forgive sins and still be a holy and just God. So Satan lost his position as the prosecuting attorney. He could no longer show up and make an accusation against God's people or God, because by the blood of Christ, the forgiveness was established and the righteousness of God was established.
That's right.
And that fits into that. The brethren was cast down. Yeah. Now, we have the binding of Satan. And most people say, how can you say Satan's bound when look everything he's doing out here? He's just tempting people like crazy, even non-crazy people. That didn't need to be in there. Anyway, the point is, Satan has nothing to do with our final judgment. It's now between God, Christ, and us as an individual. He can no longer show up at the judgment and make a charge against us. And in that sense, he's bound. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds pretty good to me, and then I ended up with an argument with a fellow I know too well, myself. And that is, if that's the case, then what's the point of how he's going to be loosed at the end if my conclusion shows he doesn't have anything to do at judgment? Judgment's about God vindicating himself. I'll hush soon, pardon me. The point simply would be, how then would he be loosed without refuting what I've just said? That looks like that would come back to a time where Satan had such power by perverted human government, I'm going to say governments, the spirit of the times, and it would appear that men's lives, that human governments would be judging men rather than God because of physical persecution. Critique that, please.
I think you're right that the war in heaven was Satan being cast out. He no longer has his prosecuting attorney's table in heaven like he did in the days of Job. He said, Job is just a hireling. That's the only reason he's serving you is because you're bribing him. And Satan lost that argument when Jesus resurrected from the dead, and then his saints became faithful martyrs, faithful witnesses. The word witness is martyr in the Greek. And they became faithful martyrs. They loved the Lord more than they loved their lives. And the devil lost. He had nothing he could say anymore. They had no sin, and they loved the Lord more than their lives. And they were willing to die for him. And in chapter 12, in verse 11, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives unto the death. And I think what keeps Satan bound is when people love the Lord so much that they're willing to die for him rather than to renounce him. And when people lose that spirit and they no longer have that attitude that I love the Lord and I love his truth more than life, when they don't have that attitude anymore, the devil is not bound anymore. And when that spirit and that attitude leaves God's people, the devil's unloosed. And it's time for the Lord to return. The Lord's pattern has always been, when his people become so small in number and are unable to influence the community around them anymore, judgment comes. It happened that way in the days of Noah. It happened that way in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. It happened that way in Nineveh. It happened in Jerusalem. And there are other examples, but the point is, when there's so few faithful and they have no influence over the community they live in, judgment comes.
Go ahead. We have time for one more question. But go ahead.
Well, in verse 11, as God's people, we may never experience martyrdom. But when the church when the church loses the spirit of martyrdom, then we're done. In the first part of that verse, pardon me for commenting long, but the first part of that verse, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. That indicates the grace of God through the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's the basis of it all. Back in Revelation, when they cast their crowns before the throne, that was people, many people who literally lost their physical life to be an overcomer. And they still cast their crowns before the throne because they knew it was by the grace of God that they were saved.
Art Lynch, and then that would be it.
Really appreciate, George, the presentation and the study on Revelation 13 here. I guess my question is more related to the governmental functions and government's role, and I'm it's kind of along the lines of what Ron was saying about the individual and God, it coming down to that. I guess I'm trying to make sure I'm understanding correctly the concept in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10 when you talk about our view or the view that was expressed there and also Jude 1 and 8 about speaking evil of governments or despising governments and those kinds of things. I guess the concept that I'm trying to make sure I understand is I don't believe I can come up with a government anywhere in the world that's a pure government from a religious standpoint or that encourages solely the principles of God. I think when we talk about Israel and the Old Testament, we saw the kind of blending of the government and the church or in the wilderness, Old Testament, and we see it in Rome, as you pointed out, and I would agree there are many, many things that governments legislate, but recognizing that government's purpose is not the necessarily the purpose of God because it is a, quote, people-driven thing, as many deviations as you see in human attitudes of, as Doug brought out, Bobby, Ron, as there are to kind of not think deeply or not use the scriptures as a guide for life, how do we maintain the position of not speaking evil of dignities and not despising government, given what, if government is becoming kind of each generation, the role of the beast? Do you understand what I'm kind of getting at there?
Well, I don't think that we should speak evil of the government, but we need to teach our people allegiance to God supersedes.